You're listening to Sex and Spirituality, a part of the teaching ministry of First Baptist Church in downtown Tulsa. We exist to glorify God in all we do.
Father, thank you for a chance to think again deeply about this, which is really the heart of everything you have to say about the purpose and meaning of creating us as romantic and sexual creatures. It's all about your design for marriage. And so today, as we look at covenant marriage and try to sum up what the Bible says about husband and wife in marriage, I pray that you would help us to reorder our own thinking in our own marriages, and also be more and more committed to defend the beauty of what you've created to others and to our families, and may the church exhibit this in wonderful ways. So be with us as we look at your word today. It's in Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so just kind of remembering where we've been so far. We started out talking about how most of us get our practical ethics from stories, not from dogma. And so we might learn ethics through dogma, but our practical outworking of how we practice ethics, in other words, what I think is right and wrong, we learn that mainly through stories. And the Bible understands this. The Bible presents the ethics of God in narrative form. It tells a story, okay? Now, why is that powerful? Because it attaches these rules or these principles to things that resonate with our soul, right? And in the absence of narrative grounding, we are at risk of conforming to the culture. So we talked about that, how, you know, something can burst on the scene, like a new version or a new vision for sexuality, like gay marriage, or new vision for gender, like transgender or gender fluidity. And if we haven't grounded our understanding of what's right and orderly and proper in a narrative, then we're going to hear somebody's story, and their life story is going to be more powerful in shaping us practically than the rules that we've learned, because that's just how we function. And that's God designed. It's okay. That's why he gave us a narrative, right? He gave us a glorious story of that can teach us about reality. So we can't just be settling for knowing the rules. We have to know the story of God. So then we spent a few weeks looking at, well, what's the dominant story, and what are the main themes in our culture right now? So we spent 2 weeks doing that. What does our culture have to say about sexuality? So we saw all kinds of things. That sex is a really big deal, and sex is also not a big deal, right? There's a casualness to sex, but also your sex forms your identity, and without it, you don't have meaningful existence. Neither thing the Bible would say. And so it waffles between those. We also saw that the general practice of people is still serial monogamy, even though marriage, which we talk about today, is now kind of approached with as risky and suspicious. Still, people prefer serial monogamy, and we understand that, being both sexual creatures but also romantic creatures that get attached to people and want to belong to each other in those ways, just kind of naturally. So we saw lots of things about the culture, and then we've been, I guess, 3 weeks into starting to build, well, what's the story of sexuality from the Bible? And we started out with gender, male and female. We spent 2 weeks on that, looking at how God gloriously designed male and female as complements for one another, so that the two that came from one could come back into one. And that requires that complementary design, and so in order for them to be one and not just two in partnership. So we spent a couple of weeks on that and talked about all of the issues around that. We're going to talk more about that as we see male and female in their marriage roles today. And then last week we talked about this really amazing synergy, how God has made us both romantic creatures and also sexual creatures. So we're drawn to the person and to permanence, right? The 11-year-old boy or girl that has their first crush is going to write, me and that person forever on their binder at school because of that romantic attachment that God's designed us in. But we also have sexual desire that draws us to the consummation of that in a physical relationship. And so, as men and women mature, what we see is God's design complementarity in how we experience romantic and sexual impulse. We experience those different on average, right? There's obviously a spectrum of how men and women experience this because we're shaped by our cultures. But in general, women have primacy on this romantic connection. That's why they're drawn to romantic stories and romantic ideals and stories of people that and how that romance unfolds. That's why the way they would describe being loved is to be fully known, right? To be fully understood and appreciated. And men are more about the physical relationship, but also just more about the satisfaction that comes, you know, from the relationship is more of a motivator. I'm in this because it's so satisfying. And the person side of it is something that develops usually in men. It doesn't lead, but it comes after. And that distinction of how men and women experience it requires us to mutually sacrifice, doesn't it? In order to have a healthy relationship. Otherwise, the male can dominate and really demean, right, what the woman would want to happen. Or the woman can manipulate and turn this into a game of rewards, right? And so either way, it becomes perverted until there's this mutual self-denial that says, I'm not going to let the way I experience these desires dominate. I'm going to respond to the way you experience them and vice versa. And so the Bible talks about sexual relationships, but also marriage relationships in that way, that it's a mutually submissive, self-denying relationship. And we can see that we require that just in how we're designed. Okay, so that's where we've been so far. So all of that's really been leading up to the proper context that God has designed for romantic and sexual desire to be consummated, to be fulfilled, and that is marriage. So our culture right now is rapidly changing in its perspectives of marriage. Now, some of it is less rapid, but historically it's still pretty rapid. In other words, since the 1960s, we've been on a trajectory of change since the sexual revolution began, which means there's been a steady decline in the percentage of us that are choosing marriage instead of singlehood or cohabitation. The number of people that are living together has tripled in the last 30 years, unmarried, right? And that's probably not surprising. But there's been a steady decline in married adults that started in the 60s, and then a rising number of those cohabitating or choosing to never marry. Choosing to have, that doesn't mean they're not having any romantic relationships, it just means they never commit to a person. They practice this, usually practice serial monogamy, or maybe casually casualness in sexuality and romance. And then public support for same-sex marriage. Now, this is something that has moved so fast. It's so unusual that a culture moves this fast on any issue, right, that has to do with society or ethics or perspective. But public support for same-sex marriage since 2007 until 2017 has risen from 37% in the United States to 62%. I mean, that is a third of Americans that in 10 years have been convinced that same-sex marriage is the right thing to do. And in that same-sex relationships are appropriate, right, for almost all of them. Now, that's happened not by, the only way for change like that to happen is through systemic, powerful messaging, right? And ever since the late 1980s, there's been a very organized, systematic movement to do that. And it gained real traction in the late 2000s, right? Gained real traction, and they've just burst forward in the last 10 years in ways that no one could predict. I mean, you remember 10 years ago, that when they were even started to debating it, when George Bush was talking about an amendment to the Constitution about marriage, and the debate started, almost every state was ready to put that in their constitution because they decided not to do it nationally. Most of the states, and several of them did, And just 10 short years later, it's 50 states wide. It's changed. So think how fast that is in order for somebody to put an amendment in the Constitution and within 5 years for it to be nationally legal. I mean, that's just really fast. And of course, this percentage change is really fast. So the culture's moving really quickly in these areas because of a very organized movement to change cultural perspectives on this and other reasons as well. And then roughly 40% of marriages today, first marriages end in divorce, and roughly 50% overall. Now, there's some argument about these statistics, whether it's lower or higher than this, because originally these statistics came out of projections, but most places say it's around here. So this creates an attitude of skepticism around marriage that so many end. It creates an expectation that I shouldn't expect permanence in marriage. Of course, it dramatically affects families. So 31% of children, millions and millions of children live in either single-parent homes or some form of guardianship. And we've seen statistics on fatherless homes that are staggering. You know, 5 times the suicide rate, 12 times the addictive substance rate. These are massively impactive things to children to not have a father in the home. Even though this is no slight against single parents, it's just... think about how hard parenting is, even with both, and with the complement of design that God's given men and women, and to try to reproduce that. There's amazing single dads and single mothers that are doing incredible jobs, and yet it's almost an impossible task to fully compensate for what's missing. And so we're seeing that change dramatically, and these statistics have been just increasing. Year after year after year. Now, marriage has been pretty stable for the last two or three decades. I mean, sorry, divorce statistics have been pretty stable. So yeah, so you can see our culture is rapidly changing. So the need for Christians to be able to not just say, and this is one of the things that frustrates me, right? When the marriage debate was raging and Christians were going on television, there's truth in what was being said often, but it wasn't in a way that could win anyone over. Like, for example, going on the news and debating somebody who's telling the stories of these couples who've been together for decades that can't be married, you know, and they're telling these passionate stories. And then they go to the Christian guy and he says, well, God is the guy who made marriage and no, you can't deviate from God's design. Well, what's the problem with that? Is that true? Yes. But in no way... promotes God's design as better, right? It just says, you know, God designed it so you can't change it. And the reality is that most of our arguments were that way. Now, there were exceptions to that, and usually those people were marginalized or silenced that had very winsome, sophisticated reasons for this. But the irony of the marriage debate was we didn't discuss children. Isn't that really interesting? Because the state's interest in marriage is almost solely because of children. Why do we have tax breaks? Why do we have laws about marriage? Because we're trying to promote the well-being of children. That's why we have the Family Medical Leave Act. That's why we have tax breaks for married couples, because we know we want to give them the resources to raise children. That's why we have child tax credits. So almost all the laws are about promoting health in the homes for the sake of the children of those homes. And so now we're talking about a vision of marriage that did not produce children. And we were not talking about children, were we? We were only talking about the powerful narratives of the romantic stories that were getting denied the right to marry. And if that ever turned to the subject of children, you know, it was quickly dismissed as like, well, then that would be true of a couple that didn't have kids, right? It's like, no, it wouldn't be true. But it would just be quickly dismissed, right? And so so we moved so fast on that. And yet nobody really was a real good proponent. So we as Christians need to be able to talk reasonably about the beauty of what God has made, not just that God has made it, I think is very important. So God establishes the first marriage in Genesis 2. And we know this passage well. And the rib that the Lord had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then man said, "This is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. and the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. So that's the story of the first marriage that God ordains. He makes male and female. He makes the participants of marriage. He brings them together. He describes this union. He pronounces it a one flesh union. All these other things are present there. So society's changing perspective on marriage can send Christians sometimes into a panic. And it's a good thing to remember that society has never really reflected this design. It's always only been the church. Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes society can be more in line or less in line with God's design. However, never has any society that I'm ever aware of had a real, what we're going to talk about today, as a society, they've seen marriage properly. Either because they were patriarchal and women were subjugated, or there's all kinds of reasons, right? But the fact that society doesn't hold the view of marriage that we do, right, is always, it's an always problem, okay? So the sky isn't falling that society's moving a little farther away, but it is becoming more urgent that Christians present, both in modeling and in winsome kind of appeal, a better view. But that's always necessary. So there's four things that we can see from this initial design, okay? First, God establishes the participants in marriage, okay? He makes man and male and female. He makes them in different ways. He makes them as a complement to each other, right? There's nothing here that complements me. Now, I've found, we didn't read that verse, but when he sees the woman, he says, I finally found the proper complement to me, right? After looking at all creation, this is the right complement. So there's distinction between those two, which is important. And then there's the fact that God created this as a pair, one and two pair. Then there's the priority of marriage that's established, to leave father and mother. So father and mother represents in all society the family connection that is usually the highest priority that you have before you form your own family, right? My highest allegiance is to my family, to my parents. And he says, in this very short passage, he says, there's one man, one woman, and they should leave father and mother and cling to each other. So that means this relationship, and the Bible affirms this the rest of the way through, is a first priority of all human relationships, even over parenting relationships. And so he establishes the priority. Then he establishes a pattern for marriage. This is the covenant union. So this language we'll know later as we see covenant through the Bible is really covenantal language, that we've become bonded or one in this resolution. Okay? In other words, our lives are staked on this, and we'll talk about covenant more. But this pattern is established in these early words. It's just the two will become one flesh. It's not just a physical description of sexuality. It's also a covenantal kind of thing. So the two will not partner together. The two will become one flesh. And then the permanence of marriage is in this text, but it's not overtly stated. But Jesus brings it out, doesn't he? When he's asked about divorce, Jesus in Matthew 19 says, he quotes this verse about the one flesh union. And then he says, because it's a creation of God, so that they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. So the point, where does he get permanence? God did that. God put them together, so we can't decide to break it for really any reason, is what Jesus teaches in divorce. So those are the four things that I see in just the establishment of the first one. It's a one-man, one-woman relationship. It's got first priority of all relationships. It's the covenantal pattern of two becoming one, and then the permanence. Let no one separate from Jesus' interpretation of these verses. Okay, so it's a creation of God. So let's talk about covenant. What is a covenant? Now, we see covenants in the Bible a lot. Matter of fact, covenant is a theme that I think unifies the entire Bible. There's a wonderful book that I can't recommend to you because it's 800 pages and it's written by theologians, so you guys would fall asleep in a few pages probably. But it's called Kingdom Through Covenant, and there's lots of ways that people have tried to harmonize the entire Bible. So the ones that you may have heard of are Reformed theology, right, that tries to harmonize the entire Bible through the covenant of works and then the covenant of grace that's expanded through election and so on and so forth. And then dispensationalism, which you may know a lot about because it's more associated with our tradition, which is that there were seven dispensations of grace, these set periods, and things changed across them. But those are just representatives of how somebody is trying to create a framework to understand the whole Bible. And I actually think kingdom through covenant is a better one than those two and most others. And understanding that from moment one to the end of the Bible, what God was about is establishing a kingdom of priests, right? A holy nation, all these images that we have, but a kingdom through the mechanism of covenant, okay? And so what you see is God creates a covenant with Adam. You know, here is your requirement, Adam. If you don't eat from that tree, right, we'll stay in fellowship. But if you, the day you eat of it, you'll surely die. So a covenant is a stipulation, right? And usually everybody involved in the covenant, the stipulation is if we break covenant, we die, right? Till death do us part. In the marriage covenant is a good example of that. When that covenant falls apart because Adam breaks it, there's a reinstantiation of a covenant relationship in Abraham, and that covenant goes through several iterations of covenants, right? The covenant with Abraham, that's unilateral. God says, this is what I'm going to do for you. And he stakes his life, his reputation on it in the imagery there. Then the covenant at Sinai, right, where they both, it's a bilateral covenant. This is your part, this is my part. If you do your part, I will be with you, I will be your God, you will stay in the land, right, and you will be blessed. And what's our commitment? We will do what you've asked us to do, and we will be your people, right? There's a unilateral. That covenant, from almost the immediate moment it was made, is broken over and over and over, consistently, for hundreds of years, right? So the next covenant is the Davidic one, right? Where he says, what I'm going to do is I'm making a covenant with the house of David to bring a king that will finally fix this old covenant problem, right? To bring a king out of your line that will reign forever and will fix this, right? So that covenant wasn't a replacement of the old covenant, but it was kind of a commitment to the house of David to bring a king out of the line of David that would reconcile all these things. I've committed to do that out of your line. And of course, then what do? In the story, we follow the story of all the sons of David, and they're all bad. You know, it's a couple of them look promising for a little while, like Solomon, but then it just ends terribly. And so you're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And of course, Jesus consummates that covenant, but he also fulfills the obligations of the old covenant on our behalf, and he instantiates a new covenant, right? And this new covenant and the old covenant, by the way, are personified throughout the Bible as what? Marriage. I married you, Israel, and you've been a whore the entire time. Sorry, but that's what the prophets say over and over and over. We're going to talk about Hosea a little bit in that regard. And then in the new covenant, Christ and the church, almost from the outset, right? Jesus' parables is a beautiful oneness marriage, right? It is the marriage, and we're going to see how that is. So, from all those covenants, what can we say about what covenants are? Well, let me see if I missed anything I'm going to read here. So we live, first off, understand you live in a society of contracts, okay? So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is if today, when we get out of this class, not now, of course, you look at your phone and you're not getting any reception, and you're like, oh, you know, well, I'm downstairs in the church. And then you go out on the street and you're not getting any reception, and then you go home and you're not getting any reception, what's going to happen, right? You're going to break your contract, or you're going to call your phone company and say, hey, I give you money and you give me service, and we have a written agreement, you know, that I signed at some point that I didn't read because we never read contracts anymore. But we have this agreement that really protects you from anything and everything that could possibly happen, and it gives me no protection. And I want to break that contract because your service is not being provided. That's how we're used to relating to everything today, right? It's a contractual culture. Whether we walk into a restaurant it's an unspoken contract, right? Or whether, even when we go to church a lot of times, I can't tell you how many conversations that frustrate, not me, because people don't do that to me anymore. I'm still too new. But Bobby or Darren, because people come up with a sense of, I contribute to this church. Why isn't there railings here? And it's not a benevolent request. It's not a, you know, can you explain to me, you know, what we're doing to prevent safety? Because I want to be an advocate for help. And if we can't do this, it's never that way. It's always, I give money to this church. This is the way it should be. Well, the only empathy I can have for that in that moment, because good grief, is that an exact assault on how people are supposed to treat their elders in a church? Yes, that's horrible. However, the only reason I can be empathetic about that is that's the only way you've been taught to behave in society, right? Now, what are contracts based on? Self-interest and distrust, right? I wouldn't have a contract with you if I trusted you. You know, none of these places Apple wouldn't make me sign my life away and 35 pages to download a song if they trusted me, right? They would just say, oh yeah, here, have this song. And if you don't pay me, that's okay, right? Or if you give it away to somebody else, I understand, you know. Because they don't trust me. They don't trust people, and I don't trust them, right? That's why I don't mind signing a contract with you, because I want something that guarantees that I can appeal if I don't like what I'm getting from you, right? Because I paid money for it. So we're used to that kind of behavior, and of course that's going to influence how we think of marriage. But covenants are not that at all. Covenants are not that at all. Sometimes covenants in the Bible, often actually, are even unilateral. In other words, it's God saying, I'm going to do this, and there's no expectation in return. Abraham's a great example of that. Abraham, I'm going to make of you a great nation. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do that. He never gets to a part where, this is what you're going to do, Abraham. All he had to do was believe the covenant, right? Now, he could have ignored it and said, well, you said you're going to do all of that, but I'm staying here. I don't want any of it. And he could work against it, but he didn't have any role in it. So don't think of covenants as contracts or even as simple as commitments. In other words, I've said I would do this, so I'm kind of committed. They're way more heavy than that. So first off, covenants always represent a lifelong bond. So there's not an example in the Bible anywhere or this term being used where what I'm promising to you, I'm not promising, to fulfill except that I die. Now, most of the time, even in covenants, is if I don't fulfill this, you're welcome to kill me. My life is forfeit. There's imagery in covenants usually like that. But this idea is this is a lifelong bond. So this is in the marriage vows, right? Unless, you know, a hipster couple decides we don't want it in there. But it's been in marriage vows for more than 1,000 years to say some version of until death parts us, right? Which is covenantal language. A covenant is not a 50-50 relationship. You know, I don't do my part and you do your part in order for us to both get something out of it. It is a 100% relationship. The vows that we make, if you've ever paid any attention to that, are supposed to reflect that. Everything that I have is now yours. Now, the Bible expresses this in lots of places, but the most prominent place is Song of Solomon, right? This celebration, long poem of a betrothal process that consummates in marriage. And the refrain that happens several times in there is, I am my beloved's and my beloved's is mine. Now, people put this on their wedding rings. Well, that is everything that I am, I'm giving to you. Everything you are, you're giving it to me. Now, we love the romanticness of that statement, don't we? But don't we practically expect more of a contractual relationship in marriage? I mean, let's be honest, right? And this is not new, okay? This is not new. The disciples expected that too. We'll talk about that later. They expected still there's some sort of contractual relationship, because when the teaching on divorce comes up, it becomes evident that even Jesus' disciples thought this is somewhat of a contract, right? So it's not new, but we expect it to be 50-50 or, you know, 70-30 or something, right? I get something for my investment. And the truth is the commitment of covenant is, no, I've decided to give everything to you, and you've decided to give everything to me. Now, there's context for different covenants, so they're not always universal, but marriage is. Marriage is. It's all that I have, all that I am, all that I will be is now yours, and vice versa. A covenant is based on self-giving, and in the Bible, the Old Testament word is called chesed, right? Chesed, God's steadfast love. It's a word that translating it as just love is not enough, not only because the way we interpret love today, which is mainly by the emotion, but also because it is something that just, in chesed, is this immovable reality, this unconditional, unchangeable reality of love. Now, that can't be emotional because we change, right? So what is it? It's and this is why it's the best way to describe it. It's a choosing. It's a choosing. It's an act of, it's predominantly an act of a will. Now, are there emotions and feelings? Absolutely, right? That's why we choose. Those are contributing causes to why we say, this is the one I choose. But covenant is saying, I chose, right? I chose. It's over. I chose. And now my posture towards you, despite what happens or whatever else, is self-giving, steadfast love towards what I said I would do, right? Towards what I committed in this oath, right? Regardless of situation, regardless of what you do in return, all that kind of stuff. We're not looking for contractual protection. That's why there's stuff in the vows, in sickness and health, richer and poorer. We're trying to put into words the fact that I'm not choosing you for favorable conditions, or because the way I feel, or because I think you can help my net worth, or whatever, you know. No, it doesn't matter. None of those things matter. I'm choosing you. Okay? That's covenant. And that is not human, right? That is not human nature in a fallen world to do that. Human nature is self-interest. And so to do that, not come what may, invokes what kind of response from Jesus' own disciples after Jesus describes this in the divorce discussion?
Better not to get married.
If that's true, we shouldn't get married. So 12 men in a culture that to not get married was unheard of, right? Because children were the only way to move forward your tribe, you know, and that was everything in terms of personal identity. So to not get married was unheard of. There weren't monastic, you know, styles. There was only that. It was glorious, right? And this is so revolutionary, as he describes, this is a covenant that people can't choose to break no matter what happens. They would go, well, that's true. Nobody should get married. Why are they saying that? Because this could be a 99-1 situation where I marry somebody who for the rest of my life is the bane of my existence, right? And you're saying, because God put this together, I'm stuck. That's exactly what they were thinking, right? So that's a bad deal. Contract language. It's a bad deal. And Jesus, what does he say? Oh, no, you misunderstood me. No, he says, it's not for everybody. It's exactly what he says. It's not for everybody. Some will choose to be single for the sake of the kingdom. Some are born not desiring this. Some will have things happen to them along the way that means they no longer get married, right? There's all kinds of reasons why people wouldn't choose to say, I give everything that I have to you, right? And Paul actually does that for spiritual reasons. He's the eunuch that does it for spiritual reasons, for the sake of the kingdom. And he says, oh, I wish everybody could do this because I'm so free to obey God in whatever way he calls me. I don't have my entire life belongs to somebody else. That's a huge obligation that I don't have. I wish you could be like that. But, you know, if you desire marriage, you desire a good thing. That's, you know, that's what he says. But he says, yeah, for me, this has been beautiful. But yeah, so Jesus kind of affirms that and says, you're right. If you're not ready to give 100% of you away unconditionally, you're not ready to get married. So, of course, our culture doesn't like this any more than the disciples did. Probably less, right? Yeah, we're fair weather spouses, you know, that's what we are. Okay, so marriage is God's context for sex. So this class is about sex and gender. Now, where do you see this in the story? And the man and the wife were both naked and were not ashamed, okay? So Obviously, there's not the consummation explicit in this relationship. It's a very short telling of the story of Adam and Eve. But this is obviously representative of the intimacy of physical relationship, naked and not ashamed. Now, here's the question. Why are they not ashamed? If any one of you were naked right here, I guarantee you, you'd be ashamed. Now, so what are the two possibilities as to why they were not ashamed? Well, one, they had perfect bodies, right? This is pre-fall. So maybe they had perfect bodies, and so there's nothing to be ashamed of. They were just created by God. Maybe they look like the ideal for male and female. Well, the reason I don't think that's a good explanation is because, first off, there's no indication of that there's some sort of ideal of physicality. And if you look at the diversity of God's creation of human beings, it seems as if there is no ideal, right? Beauty is very diverse. So that's one thing. It's just not true to our experience. Even no matter what your tastes are, you know, I would see beauty is very diverse among men and women. And so that doesn't seem to make sense. Also, insecurity is not usually based in physical realities, but mental perceptions, right? So the reason I feel shame about my body is not usually because of how it actually looks, but how I either desire it looks or how I feel like somebody else wants it to look, things like that. It's not. And that would be possible even with perfect bodies, right? So, you know, Tom Brady and his supermodel wife, they could still feel a great amount of shame, right? Why? Because they could feel vulnerable and maybe they don't like it as much, or maybe I don't measure up to the beauty of the other, or there's all kinds of reasons, right? So I don't think it's a statement of that, but I do think it's a statement of, instead of love, emotional love, right, of covenant love, of someone that has said, doesn't matter. Anything, any of this doesn't matter. I've already chosen you, right? And I choose everything about you. So what's covenant? There, in covenant love, unlike emotional love, which is fleeting, there's no fear of disapproval of the other because of that commitment. It's the way it's supposed to be, okay? This is the ideal. None of us are perfect in this. But the ideal would be on a wedding night or on the 70th anniversary, there is the safety of this person has chosen me and given me 100% of themselves. And there is nothing about me that could change that would cause rejection or disapproval. That's what covenant love is, right? And how do we know that? Because of God's relationship with Israel. Why did God make a 400-year-old covenant that never worked? So that we could see his covenant faithfulness to Israel did not change no matter how ugly they got, no matter how insignificant they got, no matter how sinful they got, no matter how much they spit in God's face. His covenant hesed for them never changed, right? Now, did they take advantage of that? Yeah, of course, right? In other words, you can take advantage of that to say, well, we can do whatever we want. There's license or puffing yourself up, right? There's all kinds of ways the sinful flesh can take advantage of that. But the beauty of that is that's what we're aiming at towards each other and spouse. So this is personified in Song of Solomon as part of the song. When the song opens, the betrothed bride starts off singing. And one of the things she says in that opening chapter is, don't gaze at me because I'm dark, because the sun has looked upon me. My mother's sons were angry with me and they made me the keeper of the vineyards. So my own vineyard I couldn't keep. So what's she saying? I'm not as pretty as I wish I was because I've had to work, right? That's basically what she's saying. I've had a life. And that life meant I'm not even an ideal version of myself, much less an ideal version of whatever beauty is, right? And so this insecurity comes out. How is it met by the man? Behold, you're beautiful. Behold, you're beautiful. Your eyes are doves. And of course, later he's going to describe his delight with almost every part of her body. He doesn't do it here because they're not married. So he does it in the moment where she's disrobing. You can even see him describing her from head to toe as he's getting to see more, right? And he's saying, every part I approve. Every part is beautiful. Is that because this was a goddess? No, it's because he chose her, right? And so this celebration of it can reduce shame, right? So think about your worst features. Now, the truth is our insecurities are rooted very deep in us, but what if your spouse loved that about you, celebrated it? Now, you could resist that and push it out and defend your insecurities, right? But wouldn't it have a disarming effect on that towards shame and shame in your own exposure if your spouse rejoiced in it? I've had experience with this in little things, you know. When my wife likes the fact that I was bald, well, I could be insecure about that. But when I know she likes it, it kind of disarms me from that insecurity. Because I know she approves of it. Does that approval come from she's aesthetically evaluating me? No, it comes from delight in the fact that I've chosen you. And so you're God's gift to me. And so that's beautiful. Now, in a culture that's programming you towards what beauty has to look like constantly, and with a completely moving target, of course, then yes, you're always tempted towards, at least with your eyes and with your fantasy life, idealizing something else other than your spouse. But that is covenant unfaithfulness in a small way, right? To say, I'm going to make the object over here more beautiful to me, because that's part of your choosing is to say, no. This is my delight. This is my beauty, right? So her dark skin, he doesn't point out. He just says, it's all beautiful to me, right? It's beautiful to me. And so those insecurities are disarmed. So that's where I think their unashamedness comes. They don't expect disapproval to come. He's just said, you're bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. I finally found the perfect match for me. It's very Solomon kind of language. So she's not thinking, I don't like my knees, right? She's not thinking that. Or I feel so vulnerable, you know, because there's that covenant relationship, okay, unconditional. So that's why this is God's context for sex. Regardless of how we numb our shame or we numb our insecurities, all these other things, or try to talk ourselves out of that, or plastic surgery our way out of that, or, you know, diet our way out of that, whatever we try, as long as we're approaching it that way, what are we doing? We're trying to find somebody, or we're trying to appeal to somebody, or even our own spouses, by giving them more in order for them to gain more, right? Or to stay, or to reciprocate or something. You're like, that's just the wrong way to think about it. Now, is it wrong to strive to be healthy or strive to take care of the body? No, none of that's wrong, but it's wrong to do it for those reasons, right? And this is a powerful lesson that all young girls need, right? It's not wrong to want to take care of yourself, to want to present yourself as beautiful. It's wrong to do that for the point of winning someone or impressing someone or drawing attention, because that's not what these things are for, right? And even we know that. We know how if somebody did that successfully, what would it draw out of me? An instinct to marry? No, an instinct to use, to have a more of a contractual relationship. The instinct to marry comes from that deep romantic side that says, this is the person that I want, right? Okay. All right, moving on. So what is covenant love? Covenant love is not based on emotion, circumstances, chemistry, or compatibility. Covenant love is based on unconditional commitment to the promise. I made an oath, and there's no situation that would cause me to break that oath. Now, we'll talk about bilateral covenants, which marriage is, right, a little bit as we go. In other words, and I'll talk about it mainly in divorce when we get to divorce. There's a whole week on divorce. But for the most part, what we're saying in those covenantal vows is there is no circumstance, there's no change in you that could make me change those vows, right? Let me see if I find myself in the No, I think we're good. Okay. Covenant love is not blind to flaws, okay? But it responds with grace instead of self-interest. This is very important, okay? So God was not blind to Israel's flaws. He just said, as long as you will come back to me, I will extend grace to you in those flaws instead of self-interest. I'm not going to do what's better for me. I'm going to do what's possible with you. Now, eventually, God divorces Israel, right? Gives her a certificate of divorce. So that's but it's still not permanent. It's not a permanent putting away of her. But the exile was personified as a divorce, because you can only extend grace so far as the other person will receive it. Now, that doesn't mean you give up immediately. It means you try and 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 you try. But in a bilateral covenant, grace alone from one side can't make the covenant, right? But it does mean that as I see flaws in you, my answer to that is grace. So my hope is that you want grace. My hope is that you want reconciliation, and I extend grace, period. That's why when the question of forgiveness comes up with Jesus, how many times we have to forgive? That's a contractual way of thinking. And he says, no, no, no. You forgive as often as possible. But then there's also verses that say, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone, right? Does that mean that there's a point where I stop extending grace? No. It just means extending grace isn't the only thing that keeps a relationship. It also requires willingness on the other part to be reconciled. Okay? Now, you can still forgive. You can still extend the grace of forgiveness, but not reconciliation. Covenant love sees flaws and responds always with grace. God is our model here, instead of self-interest. So characteristics of covenant love, these mainly come from 1 Corinthians 13, of course, but other places. Forgiveness, forbearance, patience. The biggest one I would want you to remember, hopefulness. What does that mean? It means so many marital problems, and this is true of my own marriage, would be fixed if we would just take a lens of hopefulness always with our spouse. What is the best possible light to interpret what they just said? What is the best possible light to interpret how they're trying to lead or how they're trying to support me? What is the best? Let me take a posture of hopefulness. So in 1 Corinthians, it says, love hopes all things. That's basically what that means. Why? Because I've chosen you. So I'm always hoping for the absolute best. 90% of our problems are we're seeing the worst. And we're taking comments from our spouse and he doesn't care about me at all. When that's the farthest thing from the reality of interpreting that thing. But that's the worst possible interpretation. So always saying, he came home and he was really short with me. What's the best way I could interpret that? Something's going on with him. He had a rough day, or maybe sin has crept into his life. Maybe he didn't have his devotional in the morning. What can I do to help, right? Instead of taking it personal and receiving everything with contractual eyes instead of hopeful eyes. And then selflessness, right? Love does not envy, it doesn't boast, it's not proud. All these things are saying it's selfless, it's selfless, it's selfless. It always gives. So it's a 100-100 relationship. Covenant love is in marriage is rooted in the covenant love of God. This is what's really important. The only model we have, and the only reason we would ever do this with a person, even though we want permanence with people, the only reason we would ever do this 100-100 relationship is because we've seen it in God and we have it with God, okay? So 1 Corinthians 4, 18 and 19, this is how we know what love is, right? Because God has loved us, so we love our brothers. We've learned this through God. That's why when they break covenant with God, right? They haven't done anything to each other. When Adam and Eve break covenant with God by eating from the tree, what enters into their relationship? Shame. But between God, but also between self. They realize exposure. They realize there's another, you know, person, there's another soul here that I'm vulnerable to, and that creates barriers. It creates shame. So it's derived from a covenant relationship with God. That's why God says, wives, fulfill your role in this, which is characterized by submission, as you do it to the Lord. Because if you're not doing it to the Lord, there's no hope for you, right? There's no hope for you. But if it's modeled after the hopefulness I have in God. Now, how often in our relationship with God do we not like at all the way God's leading our life, but we have to hope in Him, right? That He knows what He's doing almost all the time in some aspect. Well, He's saying that's the way you have to be, have to hope in your husband, that you have to be hopeful in that role as well. Okay, so that covenant love flows through the covenant love of marriage. That's the model of it. The Bible's written in order to show us what does that hesed look like, extending from God as He pursues His bride despite her wickedness. The most powerful image of this is actually in Ezekiel, where he tells this parable kind of story about what's Israel like. And he says it's like a baby that right after birth was thrown into a field, bloody and just thrown into a field, discarded. And God is like the one who comes, washes her, cleans her up, you know, takes care of that baby until it's mature enough to marry, and then it goes off and abandons him and whores with all kinds of people. And then he comes back and says, I'll still marry you, right? It's in Ezekiel. He's like, that's what covenant love looks like. That's pretty powerful, right? That's pretty extreme. But that's kind of the whole point of the Bible, is to say that's how I love. And the marriage relationship is supposed to be the most powerful expression of that God's designed. Okay, so the mystery of marriage, this is what Paul calls the mystery in Ephesians 5, is that it was always mainly purposed to show the gospel, to be a particular display of the gospel. Now, why does he say it's a mystery? Whenever Paul uses the word mystery, and he uses it for various different things, he never means something we don't understand. He means something that was hidden at one point that now is revealed. And so it's only now that we understand that the whole time this was about that. So what he's saying is since Christ has come and we see Christ in His relationship with the church and all these marriage metaphors in Jesus' ministry and all the way up, he says, now we understand the whole purpose of marriage was to point towards Christ in the church, was to preach the gospel in a visible way. That's what marriage was created to do. So in that way, I want you to remember that little phrase, marriage is a gospel parable, right? So what are parables? They're stories that are not related to what's trying to be conveyed. In other words, the fact how we relate as a couple and the fact that we're together and that we're having children and all that, none of those details relate to the main point. The main point, though, is it points to one global truth when it's done right. This is the way God feels about you. This is the way God feels about you. And this is the way the church trusts God, right? That's what it's supposed to show. Now, what do we learn by the fact that the Bible says that the ultimate meaning of marriage, and this is it in Ephesians 5. He quotes, you know, Psalm 2, just like we just read. Therefore, man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife. The two shall become one flesh. Statement of the first marriage. Here's the profound thing. Here's the profound thing we didn't know. It's what Paul says. This refers to Christ in the church. You'd never figure that out in Genesis, but you figure it out in Jesus, right? So he's not saying we don't understand it now. He's saying we didn't know it, and now it's revealed, right? Okay, so the ultimate purpose of marriage is to display God. Now, we see that in the Old Testament. We'll talk about it because God uses marriage as an analogy of His relationship with Israel, but not as the primary purpose and not Christ in the church. And now we find out that particularly it's the relationship between Christ and His church. So if that's true, which I believe the Bible says is clearly true, that's the main purpose of why God instituted marriage, as a display of Himself and particularly the gospel between Christ and the church, then here's what we can kind of surmise from that. First, marriage is permanent, meaning lifelong, but not ultimate. Why is that important? Because there are unmarried people. There are marriages that fail. Does that mean that that person can't have a satisfying life or can't fully embody the gospel? No, it doesn't, right? But in order for it to look like Christ in the church, it's got to be permanent. So, you know, if somebody ever asked you and says, I'm thinking about getting a divorce, how do I know if I need to get a divorce? Say, well, is Christ ever going to abandon the church?
Well, no. Well, then the answer is no. Now, that's a little reductionistic, right? Because you could find out that that marriage has already ended because one person refuses through constant behavior to keep covenant. But the simple answer, and that's the way Jesus answers it, so I don't feel too bad answering that, right? That there is no divorce in God's eyes, right? That only comes from sin. God's eyes, this is permanent because it's designed to image Christ's commitment to the church. So for a husband to abandon wife is saying, oh, Jesus could abandon the church. Or for the church, or for a wife to abandon her husband is saying, eh, the church may decide at some point we'll get a new leader. That's basically what he's saying. So marriage permanence is based on God's covenant faithfulness. When can a husband divorce his spouse? When Christ forsakes the church. The biblical example of this is the book of Hosea, right? Hosea is the one ministry I did not want God to call me into. So he tells Hosea, I want you to marry this incredibly damaged person. Who knows what her life story was, but she was in prostitution, and it was she must have been in prostitution for so long that it was basically a compulsion, an addiction, a lifestyle. So not only is he going to have to accept, you know, and forgive all of the past sin, it is an ongoing reality for his entire marriage that she returns to prostitution, that she's chronically unfaithful. And yet, what's Hosea supposed to do? Divorce her, because adultery breaks marriage. Nope. Stay with her. Why? Because I stayed with Israel when they whored around, right? And that is the image of your life, Hosea. That's what you're here for. To show Israel, as they look at you and wag their head and go, man, what an idiot. What a tragic tale of woe. They're supposed to see what they've put me through. Right? As they see the pain of that, as you go in and bust her out of a bed with somebody else and clean her up and take her home and say, you're still mine. They're supposed to see in vivid detail. Of course, he does this with Ezekiel too. Vivid detail. Lie on your side naked for however long he has to, you know. There's vivid detail in some of these prophecies. But Hosea's life is supposed to say marriage is permanent. Right? Now, that's not the main issue. It's teaching about the undying covenant faithfulness, the chesed of God. But that's the basis for the permanence of marriage. So any Christian should say, I will do anything and everything possible to save my marriage. Now, when we get to divorce, we'll talk about, does that mean that Christian marriages should never end, period? If that was the only thing you knew, 99% of the time, you'd be right, okay? But there are a few situations where, because this is a bilateral covenant, we'll talk about where it's now become impossible. But we are far too simplistic in saying what those are. So we'll talk about that when we get to divorce. So remaining married then has nothing to do with staying in love. Has nothing to do with that. Now, why is that good news? Because you will not stay in love. None of us do. It's just not human nature. We'll come in and out of that feeling. You know, I am incredibly blessed by my spouse. She's far more than I deserve. She's amazing in every way. And there have been moments where I'm like, I would prefer death to this day. I'm serious. And the reason is not because she did something so bad. It's because what we have is so deep. So the wounds are so heavy, right? They're just so heavy. Because I know I'm called to. And so that's why Hosea is such a vivid example, you know, of God asked somebody to do that. You know, one time I felt my wife was belittling my intellect when I was just talking, and I was mad for days, you know. So, and she probably wasn't even doing that, you know. It's just the way it hit me or something. But it just wounds me so much, right? And so much pain can come in because of how deep these relationships are. So if it's about staying in love, it's about, you know, going to a marriage therapist and prescribing date nights to keep the fire alive, you're going to lose. Or you're going to be that rare unicorn couple, right, that kept it, which is not usual. It's not typical, and it's not promised, right? If somebody did have that experience, oh, we've been in love since we were 18, you know, whatever. But that's unusual, right? There are not typically marriages that can say that. So even if there are exceptions to the rule, that's still, even for that couple, if that's the basis of why they're together, that looks nothing like Jesus. It looks nothing like Christ in the church. If you guys are just so compatible and good for each other, and that's why you stay together, well, you can't see Jesus in that, right? So we stay together despite the fact that we will not stay in love. Now, is it important to do all you can to continue to fuel romantic and sexual energy for each other? Yes, because you have commands that God's given you that is part of keeping your covenant commitment that you don't want to be a burden, you want to be a joy, you want to be a delight. So it's not in order to strengthen your marriage that you do that, it's in order to delight in obeying God, right? When my husband wants to have a sexual relationship and I have feelings towards him that makes me say, it makes me come up with any lie I can possibly come up with, right? I'm disobeying God. That's why I want to change that. Not because of his worthiness, not because of anything else, not to save my marriage. My marriage should be fine because I said, until death do us part. I'm not dead, so we're fine, right? We're staying together. But that's not God's goal for marriage, right? God's goal is it displays Christ, and so there should be delight in spouse. So I'm not saying those things are unimportant. They just aren't about that. Now, here's the really powerful thing, and we're going to see this in a quote, a really great quote. I'm going to quote Dietrich Bonhoeffer a lot because I love a lot of things he says about marriage. But if you have the chesed and that is your basis for marriage, it will naturally fuel staying in love. Why? Because there's no doubt. I mean, we talked about this. There's no doubt. We went through a train wreck. I put on 60 pounds, whatever. There's no doubt that my spouse is not going anywhere. And what does that fuel? Affection, peace, right? So Dietrich Bonhoeffer says it this way. It's not your love that sustains the marriage. From now on, once you say I do, it's the marriage that sustains your love. So much marital counseling gets this backwards. Hopefully biblical counseling doesn't, right? But so much marriage counseling is about how to get the spark back. And you're just like, get the commitment back. Get the covenant hesed back. Get the, I will stay with you no matter what till death do us part. No matter what happens to either one of us. Get that back and affection will follow, right? Now, it doesn't mean you don't do other things, but that's the key, right? If you both feel that commitment to each other at that level, it fuels love. Okay. So, therefore, marriage is a shadow, okay? It's the shadow of Christ in the church, cast on the world. We can't see the spiritual reality of Christ in the church. Can't see that, but we can see marriages. And so every one of the marriages should be a shadow of the relationship between Christ and the church. Marriage, so this is one of the reasons that all Christians don't have to marry. Marriage is incredibly important as one of the ways God wants to display the gospel. But I can display ultimate reality as part of the church as well, right? In my relationship with God, in my submission to Him and His headship over me. So it's not ultimate, right? It's not ultimate reality. It points towards that. Marriage is also not eternal. You know, there is no marriage in heaven. Jesus gets asked about this. What's going to be the situation in heaven? He's like, you guys misunderstand. Marriages here are about an ultimate reality that they point towards an ultimate reality that's in heaven, but the shadows aren't still there. It's the reality that's there right now. So marriage is not eternal. It's not necessary. In other words, people could choose to exhibit the gospel in their life without marriage, though marriage is one of the ways that God's intended it for it to be displayed in the world. And it's not guaranteed. So you may want marriage, and it's not God's plan to display himself through you. So we hold it loosely, our desire for marriage, right? We can express that desire to God. We understand that he wants to give us the desires of our heart, but he knows better than we do as to what's the best way to make our life an aroma of Christ. And so it's not guaranteed to anyone. Marriage is one expression of following Christ. And following Christ takes precedence. This is another good one. This is why divorce is sometimes even a reality. We'll get to this later. So I remember we talked about this with the covenant love in marriage is derivative of the covenant love of God. Okay, it's derivative. And so my commitment to God in covenant is bigger than my commitment to my spouse, even though it's the highest priority relationship. That's why you get some really weird statements in the Bible, like Paul talking about the urgency of being ambassadors for Christ. In 1 Corinthians 7:29, he says, "Let those who have wives live as if they know none." Let those who have wives live as though they had none. What does he mean by that? He doesn't mean go, you know, to this bars and pick up women, right? Doesn't mean take your wedding ring off. He means there are things that a married man might not be risk-taking in that are obedience to Christ. That he has to say, I check the fact that I have a family that depends on me on the fact that this is clearly what obedience to Christ would require, right? So the disciples, a lot of them weren't married, but some of them were the apostles, right? We know that, but we don't see their wives usually mentioned. And they were putting themselves in incredible jeopardy. They were probably putting a lot of strain on their families. Now, they can't do that unilaterally because they're one flesh. They have to do that as a unit. Right? The husband has to lead the wife to that as a unit, and we'll talk about that. But still, there's lots of things he might be doing. He's like, I'm doing this as if I don't have a wife at home because God demanded this of me. Right? That's what he means. There's a higher priority of that. And so the same would be true if you want to be a submissive wife, and he says, you can't take the kids to church, you can't go to church. You know, now there might be other ways around that. You might be able to say, well, we're going to watch videos, or we're going to read the Bible together. You know, there's other things. But there are things that could be demanded of you that you're like, I got to act as if I don't have a husband in this situation, because this is clearly disobedience to Christ. Now, we have to be careful with this, because what I don't mean is if one person in the marriage thinks this is God's will and another person thinks this is God's will, I got to do what I think God wants me to do. Because that's almost all, it's all the time that happens. I'm not talking about that. Talking about when clearly, I'm talking about situations like Peter before the councils when they said, stop talking about Jesus. And he said respectfully and still in a submissive way, but who are we to obey? You are God, right? In other words, he's put in a situation where clearly it would be disobedient to God not to. So we can hyperextend that to say, I believe this is God's will, so it's got to be right. Because a lot of times that's extended to circumstances that aren't commanded. We just feel like that would be better according to what God wants us to do. And that's different. Okay. Luke 14:26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he can't be my disciple. Now, what does that mean? We have to be self-loathing. We have to hate people. No, that would contradict the entire Bible, right? He's saying there's no comparison between your covenant faithfulness to God and to anything else, even your own survival. This has to be first. If it's not first, you're not fit. Okay? So marriage is a shadow of ultimate reality. So it has a proper place, in other words. It's not ultimate. And so it has its proper place under the Lordship of Christ, and it's not necessary or guaranteed. Any questions so far? I've covered kind of a lot of stuff. Okay, we'll move on then. Marriage as a unity and not a partnership. So in that very first situation, he takes the one that he's created, the one human being he's created, he makes from them two. And then when he brings them back together, he says, your intention in marriage is to become one flesh again, right? And all covenant relationships in the Bible are this. And so that's why the 100%, 100% equation isn't mathematically inaccurate, right? Because you're like, if we both gave 100%, then neither one of us would have anything, right? I'd have her and she'd have me, but I wouldn't have myself, you know.
whatever. You can get into semantics like that. No. Because we're creating a one flesh union requires all of us in order to create the one thing that God's asked us to be together. So sexuality is the consummation, the full physical expression of one flesh unity. That's why Paul in his teaching says, when you go to a prostitute, you're becoming one flesh with her. He means you're doing the completing act that's meant to be the full physical expression of the fact that, hey, now we're one. I've given 100% of myself to you, and you've given 100% of me. And he's like, you belong to God, and you're doing that. You're making covenant kind of consummating acts with people. So he's not saying that means they're married because they had sex, right? He's not saying that. He's saying you're consummating a oneness relationship with them when you already have a primary oneness relationship with God, that he says, if you want sexuality, there is a pattern after our relationship that you can have, which is marriage. And when you do it at a prostitute, you're just breaking that pattern, as if it doesn't matter that everything in your life image your one flesh union with God. Make sense? So that's why he says that. He's not saying you're married to anyone that you have sex with, but he is saying that's what sexuality is. It's the full physical expression of the one flesh unity. One flesh unity models the unity between Christ and the church. The primary emphasis in the scriptures about Christ and the church is what? Christ is the blank of the church. What? Well, yeah, that's true too. No, Christ is the groom. The church is the bride, right? But what's the other thing? Christ is the blank of the church. Head. And the church is the body, right? We understand. We're the body of Christ and he's the head. So they have a particular relationship that's modeled in something that's one, right? So it's not he's the leader and you guys are the disciples. It's he's the head and you're the body. There's a oneness there. There's a submission of mutual submission of independent will to now what's good for the whole, right? I don't worry about the fact that my head is in charge of my body. Why? Because it always works in concert. If I was constantly having thoughts in my head like, why don't we get rid of that arm or, because he's been hurt 3 times this year and I'm just sick of it. You know, if I was having thoughts that were antithetical to the body, of course that would be, psychotic, but it would also be, oh wait, there's two independent things at work here. If my arm started punching my head, right? It was like, why? Because it's cold here and take us somewhere else, I don't know. And you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why? Because they are distinct and they have their own role in the body, but there's never disunity there. Now, that's never the full case, right, with the church in Christ, in this life anyway. And it's never the full case in marriage, but that's what we're going for, right? Not partnership. Not, I'll do my part, you do my part, delegation of duty, we'll figure it out. Where you're strong, you can take lead. Where you're strong, you can take lead. It can't be that. Why? Not because that wouldn't work. That's what I don't like when sometimes Christians say, oh, that won't work. Of course it might work. You might have a very effective partnership, but it won't show Christ in the church, will it? It won't do that. And that's what marriage is for. In order for Christ in the church to be shown, you have to see this glorious submission and this self-denying, life-giving headship working together in oneness. Without that, it's still two. So effective partnership always falls short of displaying God. One flesh unity requires two things. Mutual submission of self-interest, okay? And not more by one than the other. Both husband and wife have to say, it's not about what I want anymore. It's about what's best for us, period. And I can give you countless examples of wonderful Christian men, even guys like William Carey, who started the missions movement, who made huge mistakes in not making oneness decisions as they did that, because they knew that God was asking them to do it. Well, they weren't doing mutual submission of self-interest. And then the second one is it requires unique and compatible roles, which the Bible calls headship and submission. Without that, you can't be one. You can only be partners, right? If we're both doing everything, sharing responsibilities, of everything, it will never look like oneness. And so the unity of the body is given as the visual representation of that. There's nothing to fear in the fact that my head is in control because of the way the body works. Now, we'll talk about, well, of course, you know, male headship is far from perfect, and it can be absolutely awful. So what do you do then? We'll talk about that as we go, okay? Okay, the next thing, if marriage is about the gospel, right? What is the gospel? The gospel is Christ, the image of Christ, which we just talked about. And so that's one of the reasons that one of the ways we image Christ is by being a unity like Christ in the church. But also the gospel is about disciple making, right? What's the gospel? Make disciples of all nations. So how does marriage make disciples? That's what I love about the instructions to husbands and wives. Both of them are instructed to do their job for the sanctification of their spouse. Have you ever noticed that? 1 Peter 3, we're going to cover this later. He's teaching on 1 Peter upstairs. We're going to preach through it. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands so that even if they don't obey the word, in other words, you get a bad husband, right? Even if he's not doing what he's supposed to do, they will be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. What does that mean? You doing what God designs you to do will be half an expression of the glory of Christ, and it can win them. Another place where this is when Paul gets asked the question, I'm married to an unbeliever, should I divorce them? He says, no, you are a sanctifying influence on that home. In other words, as you do what God made you to do in that home, your husband could become more and more like Christ, come to faith, your children are being sanctified. So as long as he's willing to stay, and we'll talk about what that means, as long as he's willing to stay, there's no abandonment, there's no commitment to abuse, there's no chronic unfaithfulness, these things, you can't keep covenant with that. You just can't, because it's a person, it's a unilateral commitment. But as long as he's willing to stay, you stay. Because that's your disciple making. You're trying to make your husband and your children into disciples, and you are the ambassador to that family. So even if you have a husband that's not doing his job, as far as I can without disobeying Christ, right? We talked about that. I do my role because they will be one without a word. And this is the nature of men. I hate to tell you this. You know, men are not won over by domination or by argument usually. But they are won over by conduct. And I just don't know how to express this. Now, I know I'm a Christian husband, so maybe I can't speak to what it's like if you're married to a non-Christian, and so I'm not going to try to do that. But I can guarantee you that if I'm not leading properly and my wife chafes against that or questions it or takes the reins for herself, it does not help me not do that anymore. It emboldens me to do that. It emboldens me to continue to fight because she's unworthy, right, of me actually laying down my life to lead her properly. When she says, I don't understand what you're doing, I don't know that it's the right thing, but I know you're God's gift to me as a husband, and I support you, and I believe in you, it creates in me this kind of accountability that starts to seep up. Maybe not in that moment. Maybe in that moment I go, oh, good. You know, I thought that was going to be a fight. But eventually I start to feel, you know, eventually what do I start to feel? Man, she's completely counting on me to do this. I can't get this wrong. You know what I mean? And my wife is even more this way because I don't think it's in women's nature for the most part when a man gives the reins over for them to go, oh, this is great. I think their nature is to go, oh, what if I mess it up? Because I'm responsible for all of you. And the husband should feel that all the time, right? And he's able to. God somehow made the male nature to say, that's an honorable, that's an adventure, that's something I want to do in the goodness of maleness. Now, passivity is the sinfulness of maleness. But in the goodness of it, he's like, I want to step up to that. I want to step up to being the soldier that falls on the grenade. I want to step up to those kinds of things. That when the wife is actually thrust into that, it usually creates panic because of love, right? Not because of insecurity, but because, what if I do something and it's not actually best for you? Then I'm responsible for that. Sorry. I'm responsible for that. I don't like this anymore, even though I get to do what I want. Well, what they feel in small ways, we actually are made to take that. We're made to take it on our shoulders. Okay, now, I'm not saying every woman always feels that. Maybe they felt dominated for a long time and they get freedom and they're like, great, I'm going to run with it. But eventually, it will probably catch up to them, especially if the husband is being a supportive husband, you know, a self-giving husband. Okay, so wives, it's counterintuitive. And the male side is counterintuitive too, okay? But even if your husbands are not doing it right, you can win them best through doing what you're doing right. You can sanctify them. So marriage is designed to sanctify husband and wife. If you haven't learned this about marriage, that the best way God's going to make me more like Jesus is through marriage, then you're missing out on really the greatest opportunity for sanctification. I'm a decent teacher. Darren's a decent teacher. I expect every one of you will grow more in Christ through your spouse than us, no matter how many years we get teaching you, if you do it right, right? Because God's made it to sanctify us. Ephesians 5, 25 through 27, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her that he might sanctify her. Why does he make this sacrifice? So that she could be more and more in the image of God. And when we lead in the right way, that's what it instills, right? It imbues Christ-likeness, hopefulness, trust, peace, all these other things when we lead in the right ways. So I'm doing it not to be in control, not to dominate, but because it will have a sanctifying effect on her. And what I desire is 100% of my energy to go for her good, and the highest good is that she be conformed in the image of Christ. And then, of course, marriage is disciple-making is also, marriage is meant for children, right? It's very obvious that God created human beings, and part of their initial command is to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That's definitely what marriage is for. That's the context. Without marriage, there will be exceptions to this with exceptional mothers or exceptional churches coming along children. But without marriage, even if you have two parents, without marriage, children suffer. And we should expect that. Why? Because God designed this context of two people who've radically said, I'm giving all of myself for you, and I'm giving all of myself for you to be the context of child flourishing, right? So marriage is meant for children, but not just making babies, right? Making disciples. God intends marriage for procreation, but making disciples. Children are central to marriage, but not essential to God's design. In other words, if there's a childless marriage, is it somehow deficient? No, because they can still be about making disciples. It's deficient if that couple is narcissistic and they just enjoy life together instead of saying, we don't have kids. We should go on more mission trips. We should do more ministry because we have the freedom of that we, God hasn't blessed our union with children, right? So let's make disciples in a different way, or adoption, or foster cares. There's a million ways. So children are central. In other words, nobody should get married and say, I want to be married, but I don't know if I want children. That's what I mean by central. I mean, well, that's what marriage is for. And here's why a Christian should never say that. It's not because all Christians are going to say, I love kids, right? It's not because of that. It's because all Christians are called to make disciples. And having children is the greatest discipleship opportunity that you have, period. Why? I get my whole life with this kid. There's nobody you will impact in the history of your life more than your child. So if you're serious about making disciples, yay, I got a kid, right? I can correct all my mistakes with this kid. I can ask forgiveness every time I'm a jerk. I wish I had more time with that person because I didn't really do all that I could to make them like. There's not that with this kid I get my whole life with to try to make like Jesus. Now, obviously, we're not in control at producing Christ in our kids completely, right? That's the work of the Spirit. But God has made promises that when we're faithful as parents, he's faithful as God. Does it mean every time that it produces a kid that is pursuing Christ with his life? But it does mean that's the pattern we expect. And if we model godly parenting
it should produce godly children. When I evangelize, I don't expect it's going to produce people who make decisions. Why? It's a small investment. There's not a lot of trust there. I don't get that much time with them. I don't get to show them Christ with my life. I don't get to show them that I'm a sinner too. I don't get to do all kinds of things. So I hope, but I don't really expect that much. When I teach these classes like this, do I hope that there's some fruit from that? Absolutely. Do I have any kind of illusion that my role, even though I'm a full-time minister, is going to be the main contributing force for any one of you in making you a disciple? Probably not. Your family, your closest friends, other things are probably going to contribute more than I do. My kids, this is the greatest discipleship project I'll ever be involved in, right? That's why children are so central, in my opinion, because this is the greatest disciple-making opportunity that we have. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer again says it this way: marriage is more than your love for each other. Oh, I'm way over. I'm sorry. I got so enthusiastic. It has a higher dignity and power, for it is God's holy ordinance through which He wills to perpetuate the human race till the end of time. If your love, you see only your two selves in the world, but in your love, you see only the two selves in your world. But in marriage, you are a link into chains of generations, which God causes to come and to pass away to His glory and calls into His kingdom. Right? There's a legacy of generations of Christ's likeness that is represented in the fact that we had a child. That's bigger than just we sanctified each other. Okay? So children aren't a blessing because they're so incredibly cute and fun, and they're a blessing because of that, right? Generations of faithfulness can come from this. Okay, let me pray and we'll stop there. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for all you have to say about marriage. There's so much in the Bible about marriage, but I hope we're starting to get a glimpse of what your story is, that the model, we can get into all these discussions about feminism and egalitarianism and patriarchy and all this other stuff, but all we have to do is look to Christ in the church. Look at that. Look at our relationship with you, and understand that that actually is something that casts a shadow that should model our marriages. And so next week, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the role of a husband, the role of a wife. And as we seek to celebrate this, to more model it in our life, I pray that you would help us. And most of all, in our inner person, in our inner dialogues about our spouse, right? On, I hate her today, or I like her today, or I want to be with her, or why is she this way, blah, blah, blah. I pray that you will help us to be more shaped by these impulses. I have given everything to this person. How can I help? How can I bless? How can I sanctify with every flaw? And how can I benefit? And how can I receive every gift in marriage so that we are both sanctified? It's in that glorious view of marriage that we have hope for permanence and joy in a world where both of us are sinners. So give us that vision. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.